This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. What a pleasure again to be with James Carse, this time in Western Massachusetts. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. The tangibility of what you're talking about, you go through elegantly these wonderful, what was your word, Bill? Contrapositions and juxtapositions.
Be in my next book.
These wonderful ways of looking at things from many sides and being struck anew with wonder, with an invitation to think beyond the constraints that are easy to get into on, you know, Tuesday afternoon. The big questions that we don't all share answers, but we all share some really fundamental questions, two of which you posit for us, you suggest for us, have to do with the reality of death and what you say is the reality of evil.
Yeah, both death and evil are two very good test issues for religion. And the way to look at it is that belief systems invariably tell you what death is and what evil is. Very easy for them to define it. And basically, one of the definitions, or one of the ways they approach it, is that it's non-existent. Let's say death. Death is, you know, if you've got a very powerful belief system, well, take the Nazis. They, everyone who died in the service of the Nazis or any kind of true believer movement becomes a martyr or is memorialized in one way or another.
And you've got to have heroes?
And you have to have heroes. In fact, heroes have to die to be heroes. So that dying is part of the heroic element of a belief system. And in a certain sense, they're never forgotten, they're never gone. And, you know, look at war memorials. They are, even the word memorial indicates that we're trying not to forget these people. And that's why, by the way, I think the Vietnam Memorial in Washington is so profound, because it's this huge black slab just sinking into the earth, and it will disappear someday. There's nothing heroic about this. Now, to look at, let's just take death in the religious context. One thing I found looking over, you know, great ranges of religious phenomena, is that there's no definition of death out there. That, for example, in Christianity, many times, or I should say in the New Testament, many times the issue comes up, what is death? For example, Jesus was asked questions about what happens in heaven. And he'd answer, God is the God of the living, not of the dead. Don't ask those questions. And then we also notice in the New Testament that death is not to be, is not easily avoided, and it's not a good thing. It serves no purpose in the grand. I mean, take the death of Jesus when he's approached in the Garden of Gethsemane and is soon to be arrested. He's in such anguish. The New Testament goes way out of its way to show you that this guy was terrified. He was sweating like his sweat was dropping like blood, the New Testament says. Compare that to Socrates, who on the night before his death was assuring all of his friends that, you know, he'll be around, he'll be out there somewhere talking to the old philosophers and so on. He was in an equable mood. He was even joking with his jailer. But in Christianity, death is at the core in its reality and is never utterly or never completely explained.
You say that there's a whole way of thinking about God and evil that is called theodicy. How come you got a good God who does bad things, basically?
Right.
And I love the way you turn that and say, you got the question wrong. This isn't about God.
If you approach a belief system, a religion is a belief system, you'd want to know that.
Yeah.
Why does God, a good God, allow evil things? Well, the question is not what God's doing, it's what we're doing with each other. And once someone says God is doing the evil, it lets someone off the hook. The important thing about evil is connecting it, attaching it to our own inner reality, where it belongs. One of my favorite remarks about evil is in Jesus's really strong remark in the Gospels, that if you're do not look for the speck in someone else's eye without seeing the log in your own. In other words, anyone who deals with evil has to start with the premise that his or her own dealing with it is itself evil.
That's a hard lesson.
That's a very hard lesson. In fact, I'm sure this is controversial for people, that I define evil as the attempt to overcome evil. That the Nazis, for example, verifiably evil, had a focus on undoing evil that was so intense that it gave them a sense of enormous righteousness.
Doesn't that sound a bit like what you call American triumphalism?
Yeah. Right.
There is currency of all these things. This isn't just idle speculation by a philosopher and historian, is it?
No, you see it everywhere. Yeah, you really do. It was very hard. Remember after 9/11 how upset some people became when it was observed that part of this was our doing, that we had a log in our own eye. Sure, those guys had specks in theirs, but let's be sure that when we come to treat this, we ourselves keep a clear view of our own evil instincts. Well, we've failed at that, I think, enormously, actually.
Well, in that context, it brings up something we will only begin able to sort of touch on, because it's just an incredibly rich subject. You talk of that event as an act of poetry, which to the average person, I being an average person, is remarkably imaginative. It's also one of the best treatments of what really happened then that I've ever seen. You and Susan Faludi approached it from one direction, which was very interesting from a mythic standpoint, and your perspective is just extraordinary in helping to understand what was really going on there.
Oh, 9/11, you mean.
9/11, yeah.
First, you need to give us the predicates on this business of this concept of authority being based either in power or in poetry. I mean, this is a huge and beautiful idea that I think starts with authority, doesn't
right,
it?
Right, it does. I think the way I chose to approach the subject in the book is through Plato, who in his Republic, which was his major statement, kind of a utopian political point of view that he had, realized that the greatest danger in the Republic is the poet. Because the poet can imagine anything he or she likes, meaning that the poet can see beyond any of your own limitations. The poet has the vision, horizontal vision, and Plato realized that in a structured society, that's dangerous. So hold your poets back, but don't get rid of your poets. You get rid of the ones you can't control, but basically what you do is to control your poets.
Now, when you say poet, you mean all of the arts.
Well, yeah, I should say that's right. It's important to recognize that. Understand that Plato meant by poetry, poiesis, he called it in Greek, the process of being creative, so that any of the arts do, any of them, even cosmetics. He said that in the Republic, from drama to cosmetics. I love the line.
So, 2,500
yeah,
years ago.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even the way you walk on the street can be poetic. So what you need to do is to control this wild poetic expression, and you employ the poets to do what will keep the mind of your community, of your believers within the limits.
Which kills the poetry.
Which of course kills the poetry.
And this is all about belief. When you say the Republic of which he was speaking was a belief system.
Oh, it's a belief system. Absolutely. Oh yeah. It's one of the great classic belief systems. If what we find are, I mean, a very good example would be Soviet realism, mm-hmm. where the Soviets, and of course the Nazis did the same thing. Well, actually, all belief systems do this, but they were brilliant at it. Is to pay certain artists to produce what the power, what the authority wants, and it's always in the end to brace up the authority.
When we come back, let us take at least a quick look at your two categories, civitas and communitas, which again offered a new way of thinking that I'd not encountered before, as so often James P. Carse does for me. We are with him in Western Massachusetts. The three of us will be back shortly. Please join us when we return.